Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In today's show, we'll travel to Athens County, Ohio, where a longtime welfare director is trying to change the way the media portrays people living in poverty.
We've gone so far in this country as to actually say that sharing with them hurts them. We overlook the fact that, you know, the average length of time of people on welfare is about 2 years. I mean, you know, again, it's all in the matter of the way we label things.
And we'll talk with Jeanette Walls, author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Glass Castle, which has been made into a movie that's now in theaters.
I've come to believe that very often these things about ourselves that we dislike so much are the best thing we have going for us. And for me, it certainly was.
We'll also hear how the job hunt is going for one laid-off miner we've been following in our series, The Struggle to Stay.
I mean, I haven't went to, like, fast food restaurants yet, but I might have to go flip some burgers, you know what I mean?
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, more than 45 million Americans live in poverty. Living on low income can create some unique challenges. And just the word poverty has become somewhat of a dirty word. So it's no surprise that with aggressive, widely publicized campaigns with names like the War on Poverty, often comes an extreme sense of shame and self-doubt. On today's show, we're going to hear different ways of reporting on financial security or lack thereof. From a coal miner who lost his job, over to a longtime welfare director, how do we talk about folks who are good at making do with what they have? How do we react when we hear these stories? Well, one woman wrote a book about her life. Jeanette Walls grew up poor in America. She wrote about it in her memoir, The Glass Castle, which has been on the New York Times bestsellers list for more than 7 years. Walls spent most of her childhood west of the Mississippi River, but her father, who was originally from West Virginia, eventually brought her back to McDowell County, where she lived for 4 years. Jeanette moved to New York in search of what she thought would be a better life. She found success in even an apartment on Park Avenue, all while her parents continued to live off the streets. Here's a clip from the movie when Jeanette's father, played by Woody Harrelson, showed up uninvited to a fancy party.
Swanky, but I don't see one of your mama's paintings.
What are you doing here?
Just networking with all these fantastic people.
Every time someone leaves, you act like a child. You'd think you'd be used to it by now.
What's that supposed to mean?
It's not a surprise, Dad.
Look around. This ain't you. You ain't like those pawns, and you know it.
Don't turn this on me.
You're a Walls. You were born to change the world, not just add to the noise. You cannot marry that fool. You're better than him, and you're better than that gossip column. You're a real writer.
I like my life, Dad.
Well, then why is all your crap packed up in those boxes?
The story is about dreaming big and a father's devotion to pushing his children to be brave enough to pursue their dreams, all the while battling alcoholism and the turbulent life that can come along with it. In her book, Jeanette Walls shares some compelling stories of hunger, bullying, and shame.
I hope that people see the movie with an open mind. You know, there's some tough scenes in it, and I think that it's basically about love and family, and there's a lot of pain in it, there's a lot of hurt, but there's a lot of joy as well. I believe it's ultimately triumphant. You know, even though it's nonfiction, we shape our truths by which stories we choose and how we choose to tell them.
Just before the movie was released in theaters, I spoke with Jeanette about why she wanted to write this book.
You know, I tried a number of times when I was younger. In my 20s, I'd write a couple hundred pages and throw it away, and then a couple hundred pages when I was in my 30s. And I tried to fictionalize it one time. I didn't know if I was supposed to make it stranger or less strange. Like, what was I supposed to change? And then one day, I used to write about celebrities for a living, and I was in a taxi in New York City, and I saw a homeless woman rooting through the garbage, and I got a good look at her, and I realized it was my mother. And I got together with her a couple of days later, and I said, Mom, what the heck am I supposed to tell people when they ask me about you? And she said, tell them the truth. And that was sort of the kick in the behind I needed to confront this past of mine that I had for so long tried to escape and tried to pretend didn't exist. I was completely convinced that if people knew the truth about me, that I'd get fired. I did not think that my book would resonate that it would sell well. That is not why I told my story. I told it because I couldn't not tell it any longer. I was just tired of being ashamed of who and what I was. I've come to believe that very often these things about ourselves that we dislike so much are the best thing we have going for us. And for me, it certainly was. This past that I tried to cut myself off from, it was the better part of me. And that's why I become such a big fan of storytelling. I think that if you can go back and revisit the sometimes painful memories, but also sometimes beautiful. The thing is, if you cut yourself off from the pain, you cut yourself off from the beauty as well.
I want to talk a little bit about McDowell County in southern West Virginia. Mm-hmm. It seemed like the writing and how you described Phoenix and places out west before you moved to West Virginia had more of a positive vibe to it. And when you get to McDowell County, there's a certain mm-hmm. darkness to mm-hmm. the language.
Yeah.
But in both places, you grew up in poverty.
Yeah.
Why was it different in McDowell?
I think it's, first of all, I think it's easier to be poor in a warm place, you know, especially if your parents don't provide heat in your housing. So, I mean, it was cold. It was cold in West Virginia. I mean, when we lived in McDowell County, coal was cheap at the time. We could have bought a ton for $35 to $50, and they just didn't buy it. It was cold, and I was hungry all the time. I mean, the school in Phoenix, it provided free lunches in a way that wasn't embarrassing. They made a big deal at the school I went to. If the lunch tickets were a different color if you got a free lunch, and Mom wouldn't let us do it. So I was cold and I was hungry. It was not McDowell County's fault. It was not West Virginia's fault. But our circumstances got very, very grim there. And I think that one of the things that also happened is that my father was born in McDowell County in Welch. And I think that returning home for him was a bit of a defeat, and he sank very deep into alcoholism because he went back with his mother and father, who were also alcoholics, and his brother, and he just got sucked back into this really destructive lifestyle. And we stopped moving around. It was always whenever times got tough, we just would stay there in one location for a short time, and then we'd move again and start afresh. Dad called it doing the skedaddle. And we just stopped moving. It was like my father had confronted his demon, and the demons kind of won. This book is in no way meant to in any way disparage West Virginia or McDowell County or Welch, which is filled with lovely, kind, generous people. But our circumstances were very, very difficult. I think that one of the reasons that this book has resonated and has been on the bestseller list for some ridiculous amount of time, like 7 years, is because poverty and hardships and addiction, it exists everywhere. My story is not unique. Some people say, well, you know, it's extreme. And you'd be surprised by some of the stories that I hear, and sometimes in very affluent areas. You know, people go to great lengths to hide their poverty, and I did.
And you described your dad in the book as an alcoholic. And,
yeah.
But
yeah.
At the same time, you also paint him in a hero's light, as very innovative and smart.
My father was a magnificent man. I adore him, and to this day I miss him. He died in 1994. He was both the best and the worst of fatherhood. You know, but anybody who's dealt with an addict knows how they break your heart. He couldn't fight his demons, but he gave us the tools to do that as children. And, you know, he just always told us that we deserved something better, that we were strong, that we were resilient. All of this traveling around, all of this chaos, he always said that was temporary, that one of these days he was going to build us a great big mansion, and he called it the Glass Castle. And when times would get tough, he'd pull out the blueprints for the Glass Castle. It was about hope and belief in yourself and belief in the future. And I believe that if a child gets that, along with a love of education and a sense of self-esteem, that you can make it through just about anything. And that's why I'm not angry with him or anybody. I mean, I certainly bear no ill will towards my family or anyone I grew up with in West Virginia. You know, there's some tough stories there, and there still are. They're good people just trying to make it out. And one of the reasons I love having written this book is that so many people come up to me and say, the details of our lives are very different, but you and I could be sisters. You know, and sometimes they were raised in fancy areas in Boston, but their father's a pill addict or something. And that's why we tell our stories. I'm not looking for sympathy, not looking to tell horror stories, but to make emotional connections with people who we might think there is no connection with.
And perhaps provide a window into this world and different realities. I mean, I know you said that you mentioned that people can relate to it, but it's also realities that not a whole lot of folks talk about. But
exactly.
showing that you can have those realities and you can still succeed and wearing it and being proud of it.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point to make. It's like, I think that some people look at, you know, poor folk and just think, oh, and put, you know, Why do they live that white trash, black trash, whatever, you know, why don't they take care of themselves? And one of the reasons that I love this movie so much is it goes beyond the stereotypes and shows that people who, from a distance, you might be able to just be able to put on a label on them and say, we know their type. But behind what we see, there's always a story. And things are much more complicated than you think. And they might look like people in desperate poverty, but there are hopes and dreams and love there as well. And that's something I hope people don't forget.
I want to get back to Welch just a little bit more. Did spending some time in Welch and meeting your dad's family, I know in the book you described your West Virginia grandparents as enormous and mumbling, and you could hardly understand some of them. And there was some sexual abuse involved in that as well. But did spending time in Welch and meeting your dad's family and your grandparents help you to perhaps understand your dad more?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'd always seen him as a hero. It's like there was nothing wrong with him except when he got drunk. Then he became a monster. But other than that, he just seemed to me this perfect, almost, you know, movie star, handsome, strong man who just that he was perfect. And then you see, oh my gosh, this is so complicated. As, you know, the little 10-year-old girl realizing that his parents are just not who I thought they would be. And it forced me to rethink him. And again, it's not because they were West Virginian or anything. I mean, there are difficult and dysfunctional families everywhere. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, West Virginia has not cornered the market on on poverty. But I think that they were very destructive in a way that broke my heart, because I loved my father so much I couldn't imagine anybody not treating him well. Mm-hmm. And it was bewildering to me. And that the grandparents didn't treat us that well either. And it was a little bit of a head turner. And so I one time heard that we become adults not when we become of age to vote or when we, you know, have become drinking age. It's when we realize that our parents are human beings too, and that they have flaws, but that they have issues. And that's okay, that they, you know, unless they're truly, truly toxic, which I don't believe that my parents were. I mean, some people might disagree with me on that, but I think they had so much love and so much goodness to give. And everything in life is both a blessing and a curse. It's entirely up to us which one we choose to focus on. You know, my father had very dark things about him, but he also had incredible moments of light. And do I want to sit around feeling sorry for myself and focus on the darkness and focus on the alcoholism? Or do I want to focus on the gifts he gave me, the love of learning, the sense of self-esteem, the blueprints for the glass castle, you know, which was a hope and a dream for the future.
That was Jeanette Walls, author of the best-selling book, The Glass Castle. A movie that's based on the book is out in theaters. Here's a scene in which Jeanette is at a fancy restaurant in New York with her mother. Jeanette's mom is emptying sugar packets into a glass of water while Jeanette offers some financial help. Mom?
Oh, your dad said he saw you pass by in a cab the other night. Acted like we weren't even there.
You shouldn't be ashamed of us just because we choose a different lifestyle than you.
Being homeless in New York City does not count as a lifestyle choice.
Well, if we heard from you more, you'd know that we found a lovely place on the Lower East Side.
Lori says you're squatting in an abandoned building. That does not sound safe, Mom.
When did you lose your sense of adventure?
I have a little bit of money now. I can help you if you want.
Mm-mm-mm. We're fine. You're the one who needs help. Look at you. Your values are all confused.
In a minute, we'll talk with Jeanette Walls about how people in West Virginia are reacting to her story and hear her response to people who say the Glass Castle is an unfair portrayal of Appalachians. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on our show, we're exploring ways to talk about resilience in the face of tough odds and about why we have such strong feelings about being poor. Now let's continue listening to writer Jeanette Walls, who spent part of her childhood in McDowell County in southern West Virginia and wrote about it in a memoir called The Glass Castle. The book has been made into a major motion picture starring Woody Harrelson and Naomi Watts. Here's a clip of the movie when the family sees their new home in Welch, West Virginia.
Welcome to 93 Little Hobart Street. $50 a week and in 2 years we'll own her outright.
Hard to believe one day this will all be ours.
Hey, she may not look like much, but wait till you see what I have in mind. Come on, come on, come on. We're gonna tear all this down and replace it with your game room. Ping pong, pool, foosball.
Trampoline?
Oh yeah, trampoline goes right over there. And then all these walls are gone. Replaced with 3-inch glass. This can stay.
Doesn't that look lovely? Yellow stands for happiness and creativity.
This place doesn't have any running water or electricity.
Ignore her, she was born without vision.
Part of the movie was filmed in Welch, the county seat of McDowell County. Wall said her friends and family in West Virginia have mixed feelings about parts of the book and the film.
It's split about 50-50 between people who like and don't like the book. A lot of people feel it was unfair, that it's not the whole story. And I respect that opinion. I really do. And it's certainly not their story. I mean, a lot of people there lived in handsome houses, had indoor plumbing, could take a bath every day. That wasn't my situation. A lot of people have said, oh, this is just dead on. This was my life, too. In fact, the wonderful, wonderful director, he went to Welch before the whole thing started shooting. He just wanted to see the setting and the scene. And I offered to go with him. He said, no, I can handle it on it. The truth is he probably did better without me than he would have with me. And he's walking down Wyoming Street, which is in kind of in downtown Welch, and he sees this sign that says the Welch Daily News. And there's a lot of scenes in the Welch Daily News because that's where I sort of learned journalism. So he just knocks on the door and he meets the editor, and they ended up filming a scene at the Welch Daily News. The people at the Welch Daily News were kind of supportive of the book, and they know, they've been out there reporting, they know that there are many families like mine that are in really tight circumstances. I mean, Welch, it used to be a really booming city, and it's fallen on hard times through no fault of anybody there, but the coal mining industry is... it's changed a great deal. Unemployment is very high. But in addition to that, they've had some catastrophic floods. And they're just really trying to pull it together and feel good about themselves. And God bless them. You know, I would love for the city to turn itself around. But it's in a tight spot right now.
The one passage that really made me cry was when you were leaving Welch and going to New York. And you talk about your dad lighting a cigarette. And it says, unlike him, she would make it out for good. So there's, you know, mixed feelings about how hard it was in West Virginia. And, you know, there's this turbulence to it. But then there's also a beauty to it, which also seemed to be reflected in your father.
Yes, I think that's very, very well said. You know, he, a very conflicted man, light and dark, beauty and harshness. And it's funny, when I was watching that film, that scene in the movie, I burst into tears. I was just, it kind of ripped me apart. Because he, you know, in leaving, was I deserting him? And again, this is something I think a lot of people can relate to. Their circumstances might not be as difficult, but I just talked to this lovely young woman who said she felt the same thing when she was going off to college. So my situation might be more extreme than some people's, might be less extreme than some, but it's not unique. You know, we all share these same emotions and same experiences to some degree.
What do you want people to take away from the book and the movie then?
I hope that when people watch the movie or read the book, I hope that what they end up thinking about is their own story. I hope that they're thinking less about me than themselves. We all have a story, and sometimes hearing or seeing a story about someone else elicits a response that makes you think about, that reminds me of the time that XYZ happened. And so far, it's been quite wonderful. A number of people have told me that they left the movie theater and then burst into tears thinking about their own father who maybe wrestled with alcoholism, or their own mother who was maybe a little bit loopy, or their own decision to leave home. And that's what it's about. I kind of feel it's really not about me. It's about families who just struggle to get by. You know, it's a complicated unit, families. There's so much love and joy, but there can also be pain and disappointment. And it's all part of the same package. And it's complicated. And I think that the director did a spectacular job of conveying the nuances and the complexities of family.
Do you think it's important for the rest of the world to sort of know these kinds of stories, specifically as it relates to parts of Appalachia and McDowell County, as far as the impact that it could have
Absolutely.
On the image?
Absolutely, I do. You know, the book was required reading in a very upscale suburb of Dallas, and one parent objected to one of the scenes in it, and so got removed from the recommended reading list. And the other teachers and the parents and the students, bless their hearts, stood up and said, "We need to know about stories like this. We are so privileged and so protected. We need to know that families are living like this." I cannot tell you the number of parents who've told me, "Thank you for this story because my kids are so privileged. They need to understand how fortunate they are." I was at one event and somebody stood up and said, "I refuse to believe that people were going hungry in America in the 1960s and 70s. And somebody else stood up and said, "You know, honey, you need to do a little more volunteer work, because this is not something that used to happen. It's something that still happens. I believe people are good and compassionate and have big hearts, but sometimes they just got to have their eyes opened up a little." And I think that that's what storytelling does. You know, the people of West Virginia are good and kind and decent, hardworking people who are in a tight spot. And let's not turn our backs and pretend that this sort of stuff doesn't exist, or to stereotype them, which is even worse, about like shiftless, why don't they get a job, whatever. You know, that it's so much more complicated than that. There aren't jobs in some of these places. These people, they might look different from you. They might live in a different part of the country. They might speak differently. But basically, we're all the same. We have the same wants and needs and desires. We all want to feel respected and safe. We want to take care of our families and feel good about ourselves in the future. And I think that's what storytelling does, is it removes the barriers that we erect to think we're protecting ourselves when all what we're doing is isolating ourselves.
And you mentioned before that you got rid of your sense of shame and that you're now, you know, trying to be proud of your background. And you talked about people, you know, outside of this region, perhaps, you know, in the message to hopefully they can take away from it. What about the folks who are here who mm-hmm, say, well, mm-hmm. we're not all like that, and still kind of encourage this kind of shame of that we should be ashamed of these kind of things, but it's still our realities. What would you say to those folks?
Well, you know, shame is a complicated thing, because it where it comes from is you think that people won't accept you. You think people won't understand. So it's a self-imposed punishment, and it's something that I completely take responsibility for. That was me. That was me thinking I wasn't as good as other people. The shame that I was feeling, it was foolish. It was nonsense. It also gave me the kick in the behind I needed to change my circumstances. But like you said, not everybody in West Virginia shares my circumstances. Mine was very extreme. This is not typical of West Virginia. It's not typical of Welch. My parents would have been impoverished if we lived in Paris or Monaco or Boston. And this was not West Virginia's problem. This was my parents, an alcoholic and a mother who was more interested in painting than writing. This is not a reflection of West Virginia. This just happens to be where I was. So this story is not about West Virginia. It's about me. People are complicated. People are nuanced. It's easy to pigeonhole and stereotype. And there can be some truth in it, but the tricky thing about stereotypes and caricatures is that it's not the whole truth. There might be a grain of truth, but that's why stereotypes are so insidious, is because there might be a bit of truth, but it's not the whole story.
Jeanette Wallace says, growing up poor has taught her a lot and made her who she is. And today she's proud of who she is because it shows just how far she's come.
A lot of us go through tough times, but I believe that those of us who endure these tough times actually can be an advantage over those who didn't, because we learned so much about life and about each other. And, you know, adversity introduces one to oneself. And the great thing, everything in life is both a blessing and a curse. And the great thing about having been raised the way that I was is that I'm a fighter and a scrapper. And the unfortunate thing about the way that I was raised is that I'm a fighter and a scrapper. And it took me a long time to understand that you don't always have to fight. That at a certain point in life, you take off the armor and there are good and kind and warm people there willing to embrace you. And if one person gets that message from this movie, then this will all have been worth it.
That was Jeanette Walls, who wrote a memoir of her life growing up poor in America called The Glass Castle, which has been adapted into a movie that's now in theaters. This next story is about a longtime welfare director who is passionate about making a difference in Ohio. The segment was part of a series called Busted, America's Poverty Myths by WNYC's podcast On the Media. The series examines various theories about why poverty persists in America, despite countless efforts to eliminate it. So why did she travel to Appalachia to take a poverty tour? Well, Jack Freck has been hosting these so-called poverty tours with good intentions for years. Here's On the Media host Brooke Gladstone speaking with Jack Freck during her trip to Athens County, Ohio.
We've always had a higher rate of poverty in the Appalachian areas because, you know, even at its peak back at the turn of the last century, when we had coal mining jobs and jobs in timber, there were still more people than jobs. And
Jack Freck has spent his entire life battling to preserve aid to the poor, including 33 years as welfare director in an Appalachian county. Standing by his black SUV, he's gray-haired, bemused, verging on skeptical, and yet still game, despite having escorted countless reporters, like me, on the Appalachian leg of their poverty tour, past rusted trailers and shacks and a few creeks tinted a bright chemical yellow.
When they were setting up a coal mine somewhere, and they would throw up these wooden houses in a day. They'd either be, you know, four rooms in a box shape, or they had what they called shotgun houses that were maybe three rooms in a line. When I came here in the early 70s as a caseworker, there were hundreds and hundreds of those houses out there. Most of them had electricity at that point, but did not have running water.
You know, he said all this before, some 30-odd years, the same tour, the same story.
In the last 20 years, the other thing that we've seen is families are doubling and tripling up in these old houses. Kids are sleeping on the floor or three or four to a bed.
He's trying to make the invisible visible.
Unless you have some reason to take a state road out to a county road and then a township road off the county road and a dirt road off another dirt road, you're not going to see them because that's where they are. And I think it lends itself to this whole idea that things aren't that bad.
And he definitely disposes of that idea because now you see. The hard part, he explains, as the day fades and we repair to his airy, well-appointed home nestled in the woods, the hard part isn't getting the media to see how bad it is. It's getting us to understand why, because we kind of think we already know.
You know, I think my first contact with the media in dealing with this really started back in the late 70s, around the time I took the job as a welfare director. And one of the things that you constantly deal with in this field is that people just, if you're not poor, it's not likely that you even know someone who's poor. And you certainly know very little about their lives. People deal in misperceptions and
like what?
Well, I think the idea that poor people are lazy. There is no misperception about poor people that is greater. There needs to be a reason why are we unwilling to share with them. And the best way is to say they are poor through their own fault. We've gone so far in this country as to actually say that sharing with them hurts them. Giving them help creates dependency, which somehow we don't apply to Social Security, unemployment compensations, veterans benefits, tax breaks for mortgage payments, all the other things that everyone gets. I mean, Medicaid, which, of course, is welfare, too. Almost everyone has to go on Medicaid. And yet, no one looks down on them because they got old and had to go into a nursing home and could never possibly afford the cost to keep them there. So we're very specific about who we decide is on welfare and who isn't. And we overlook the fact that, you know, the average length of time of people on welfare is about 2 years. I mean, you know, again, it's all in the matter of the way we label things.
So you talked about this prevalent myth within the context of your first brush with the media. Yes. Tie that together.
Well, I think for me, the way to advocate for poor people was to shine a light on them, to show that this could happen to any of us. I think, though, that as time went on, I became much more aware of how much of this had to do with racism, how much of this had to do with sexism, how much of this had to do with other issues that had nothing to do with someone's ability or how hard they wanted to work or didn't want to work. I mean, you know, you can take almost the same stereotypes that we apply to poor people and get away with now. And you can see how for hundreds of years we applied those same stereotypes to black people.
So he worked with big media to undermine those stereotypes over and over again. We see the autographed pictures of network news stars, the snapshots and thank you notes scattered all over his house. Watching the videos of Jack's network appearances, you can literally see him age, each time a little grayer, a little stouter, but always the same passion. In 94 with Deborah Amos on ABC News Nightline.
People here are able to find shelter in all kind of places and, you know, garages and small campers and trailers and things like that. Similar places don't have running water. Some of them don't have electricity.
You might say that Jack Freck is an expert on welfare. The director of human services in Athens County, Ohio, the heart of Appalachia. He's been working with the poor.
In 95 with Chris Bury on Nightline.
Jack Freck, in charge of welfare for a poor Appalachian county in Ohio, says even less money will be available in times of recession when the welfare ranks inevitably grow.
I think it will have that desired effect. It will save money. It will be at the expense of poor people.
In 2006 on Good Morning America.
At this point in our county, there are almost no manufacturers left. The last three or four of them that offered, you know, relatively decent jobs with full benefits, they're all gone.
In 2010 with Ann Curry on NBC Dateline.
Athens County Welfare Director Jack Freck sees many young mothers like Crystal and says state and federal programs just don't help them enough.
Our staff work their butts off to get these people every dime they can. But at the end of the day, we send them out of here knowing that it's very likely that the last couple weeks of the month they're going to have to go to a food pantry to get enough food to eat.
You sound a bit angry about this.
I'm very angry about this.
Poor people.
Like poverty, anger comes in flavors. And here, Jax is tinged with a kind of smoldering heartache. But back in 93, on CBS's Eye to Eye with Connie Chung, the experience elicited something closer to outrage.
Listen to this. Soon, one of every three babies in America will be born to an unwed mother. The tragedy is, two out of three families headed by single mothers live in poverty. It's a crisis that's pumping up the crime rate and choking the taxpayer.
The angle pursued in this segment was clearly shared by then-correspondent Bernard Goldberg, now conservative media critic and Fox News contributor. Here's Goldberg in the piece.
Connie, imagine an America with millions more poor people than we have now. You may not have to imagine long.
His piece featured author Charles Murray, ardent promoter of the idea that welfare leads to illegitimate children, which breeds more poverty and crime. That, in fact, the best course was to root out illegitimacy at its source.
There is a feeling that this plan to end welfare for single mothers is not just a half-baked crazy idea.
I think it's a dangerous, frightening prospect.
Jack Freck is in charge of the welfare system in Athens County.
We're justifying what essentially, in my mind, is an immoral decision by saying that we're doing this as a favor to them. Essentially, we would be taking millions and millions of dollars out of our poorest communities, and we would see people suffer greatly.
But if they suffered greatly, that's precisely the point. They might not have these kids.
Well, they might starve to death, too.
That was Jack's worst media experience. His best, never to be repeated, had occurred 9 years earlier in 1991, courtesy of ABC News.
Apparently, there was some concern by Peter Jennings and his producers that they were doing a considerable amount of coverage of the problems that Kurdish children were having as a result of the war. And there was this huge outpouring of people in this country wanting to help those people. They were concerned about this.
The crisis for Kurdish children simply reminded us that 12 million American children have a daily crisis as well, and that we should come and take a closer look at it.
Naturally, they chose Ohio.
Our unusual concentration on children in poverty is going to last a couple of weeks. This week here in Ohio, because all the statistics and many of the situations match the rest of the country.
And naturally, they called Jack Freck.
Peter Jennings came down, and you know, him and I spent the day. We went out and walked around. They shot a video of poor families, interviewed lots of people. They had correspondents in three or four locations in Ohio. And then throughout the week, it would leave the newscast, and it would be something that happened that day.
When you get close to the poor, you recognize right away that very often the level of assistance which they get from government doesn't even lift them up to the legal poverty line, let alone above it. Which seems to say that your congressmen and your state legislators have failed to recognize that children and families in poverty are a national disaster. In your name, they often argue about other priorities. And welfare cheats. 12 million American children who cheat.
The overwhelming response they got was that we don't believe this. The pictures you're showing us of these poor families and how they're living, we don't believe this is happening in America. And we're horrified. So that was, you know, their attempt to shine a light on this. I mean, this was not all sweetness and light. And I mean, they showed a drug-addicted mom over, I think, in Dayton someplace. Her baby was in an incubator. They had, you know, some poor kid up in Columbus, a 10-year-old boy, and he was taking responsibility for his siblings. And, you know, it was, I thought, excellent reporting about what was happening. You know, you're convinced that if people only saw this, if they only knew, it would make a difference. So you can imagine my perspective on this when, you know, Peter Jennings, hearing him do a broadcast every night, literally saying the words that I had told him earlier that day about, you know, what benefits are, what problems are, what struggles are. You know, here's the most, you know, famous, renowned newscaster at the time.
And a huge audience.
Huge audience.
You must have thought, this is the moment.
Yes, absolutely. And I was thrilled. I was 42 years old, and I thought, that's it. We're done here. You know, we've solved poverty.
And then?
And then nothing. Nothing.
Actually, a report released around that time by Senator Jay Rockefeller did spur legislation on child health insurance. But there was no effort to halt the decline in cash assistance to poor families in Ohio and elsewhere. Not then, and certainly not now.
It's gone in the other direction. People are less sympathetic. They're harsher now. I mean, you know, you will see folks now, you know, begin to also rail against welfare, even though there's hardly anyone left on welfare. In Ohio, 75% of the cash assistance welfare cases are child-only cases. There's only 15,000 adults left on cash assistance in Ohio. You know, we have eliminated cash assistance. You know, we don't have these kids living in orphanages. We have them living with grandma instead because the families have fallen apart and we no longer support families that stay together. So the conservatives have won the day. They've won, and we're still not happy about it. We still don't give them credit even when they go out and work. You know, they have to work off their benefits. They do. We still don't give them credit for it. We still think they're awful and terrible. So, you know, that's what I've seen evolve over all of this, and that's how I've kind of seen the media reaction to this, or non-reaction at this point. There is some renewed attention now because of the 20th anniversary of welfare reform. Had a lot of contact with folks lately. People call me up, background information, whatever. Yes. Well, I mean, you know, let's just put it on the table. I have absolutely no expectations whatsoever that this will move the needle one iota for a change, no matter how much coverage we get of this. I'm not unrealistic about that, you know, but I also know this. When Jennings and these folks did it, no one, I think, could have done it better. But what they didn't understand is they were up against a population out there who did not want to hear this, who did not want to change their minds about poor people. So no amount of information they were giving them, no amount of cajoling, no amount of this is the logical, the right thing to do, busting the myths, all that kind of stuff. None of that was going to matter when basically you had a population that wanted to cling to those things because it justified them not sharing.
That was Veteran Welfare Director Jack Freck speaking with WNYC's On the Media host Brooke Gladstone. The segment was part of a series called Busted, America's Poverty Myths. You can find more stories in this series online. We've posted a link on our website. That's wvpublic.org. Now we're going to hear from 38-year-old Dave Hathaway. It's part of our series called The Struggle to Stay. Last week, we learned more about Dave, a coal miner who was laid off when the mine he worked at closed.
Pretty much everyone you knew was a coal miner. I mean, everyone's dad was a coal miner at the time. And, heck, I used to have Kennywood days for coal miners, and it was just awesome.
Even without a job, Dave is determined to stay in Greene County, where he gets to see his son Grant on a regular basis, where his wife Ashley and now their brand new baby live. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier picks the story back up with a visit to his home just after their new baby was born.
What do you say? Can you talk yet? You can't talk. You're not even saying much.
Dave's situation changed a lot when his wife Ashley gave birth to the couple's first child, a boy. They named him Deacon. Ashley was working and Dave wasn't, so Dave watched Deacon most days. I visited a few months after Deacon was born. Inside their two-story house on the edge of the town of Waynesburg, Dave is feeding the baby out of a bottle in his living room. The NFL Network is on.
Oh, dude, hammered this. This is the most he ever ate.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I filled it
when
up.
When I first met Dave, he had a short goatee. But now he let his beard grow out.
I like when he gets milk drunk and just passes back out. A little coma.
Dave joked. He called himself the Manny. Like nanny, but with an M. Get it? Manny?
You proud of yourself? Huh? Proud. Let's burp. Get a burp. Don't puke on me.
See, how you doing changing diapers and everything?
Oh, okay? I was a pro on the first one, man. Yeah. Pretty good. It doesn't bother me. The dog crap bothers me worse than...
But Dave is still looking for work. I gave Dave an audio recorder and asked him to record himself. He'd made this recording of trying to get in touch with someone about a job application he'd submitted a while back. You can hear Deacon in the background.
And I've been trying to get a hold of these people for about 2 weeks now.
Please leave a voice message for...
And once again, no answer. And it's the story of my life.
All this time, Ashley continued to work for the coal company. It had gone through bankruptcy and was now called Contura. Ashley was hired at the company out of college. Like Dave's dad, her dad worked at the Emerald Mine, too. She said when she first started, it was a good place to work. But the mood dampened when the mine started laying people off.
They would slowly lay off the office people as well. Just seeing people leaving in the way that they did it. It didn't seem like the same place as I started.
She says it's been tough at home, too, since Dave got laid off.
I mean, we've survived, but having a new baby was definitely, it was a blessing, but it's hard because you have to think about him now and you're spending more money. because of that.
By this time, Dave had been without a steady job for 10 months. All the while, he didn't find a single promising lead for a job that could replace working as a coal miner. Compared to a lot of people in Greene County, coal miners make a lot of money. Dave made around $33 an hour at his mine. The yearly take-home is around $75,000 a year, and it can get up into six figures with enough overtime. While he was looking for a job, he only saw offers for the kind of low-wage, low-benefit work that's available in a place like Waynesburg, like a part-time job at Home Depot or Lowe's. He wouldn't take a job like that because he said he could lose the health benefits he was still entitled to for the first year after his layoff. So it was just Ashley's income, unemployment for a while, and he was cutting grass to make a few extra bucks. Still, Dave didn't really think about moving away to find work. He loves Greene County, and his son Grant lived nearby with Dave's ex. And Ashley, too, wanted to stay here. Her family lived in the area. Eventually, Dave's unemployment ran out. He started to get worried. It wasn't just the money. It was also feeling he was unable to provide for his family, which, as a man, he felt was his responsibility.
For, I think, the man of the house not to have a job is pretty disheartening. I mean, it's a hit to my ego, really. I mean, Ashley's the breadwinner. I mean, it's cool she has a job, but I mean, I need to chip in.
Then one day, he was offered a job working at a warehouse. The money would have been decent, and it wasn't at a mine, so he wouldn't have had to go underground.
Which I'm not scared to go back underground, but if I don't have to, I don't want to. Yeah. But that's it, man. That's the only, out of a whole full year of applying for jobs, that's the only company that's called me back on anything. I mean, that's anything, including Walmart. I haven't went to like fast food restaurants yet, but I might have to go flip some burgers, you know what I mean? But as of right now, we're still making it. I figure probably in a month or so, it's going to wear on us. So, we'll see.
Are you like burning through savings and stuff?
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's already ripped through. Pretty much. I mean, we probably have maybe like 2 months with our bills and everything, and then everything will be wiped out.
I should probably mention this was back in 2016. You might remember Donald Trump was promising to put miners just like Dave back to work. Throughout the campaign, Dave told me he wouldn't vote for either Trump or Hillary Clinton. He said he didn't trust that anything Clinton said was what she actually thought. And Trump said outlandish things and seemed like a wacko. That was Dave's word. Trump was in favor of coal, but Dave questioned if the president could really bring the industry back. Dave still held out hope he would get rehired by the coal industry, but it didn't really directly relate to the campaign. You see, Dave is in a union, the United Mine Workers of America. So when his mine closed, he was basically put on a waiting list for another union mine nearby. His old company still owned the Cumberland Mine, a few miles from his house, and they were still under contract with the union. Eventually, Dave could be offered a job there. Eventually. But he had no idea when or if, and he was pretty far down the list.
Now, I mean, I'm on the panel for Cumberland, but I'm like, my seniority, I'm probably sitting there like 70. So, yeah, I don't think I'll ever see Cumberland. I'm not even really, like, that's not even, like, a main focus for me. Like, it's actually, like, way down on the totem pole for me. I'm not hoping for it.
As the year wore on, he saw his number get smaller and smaller. And so, feeding an infant on his knee, he kept putting in applications and wondering if the Cumberland Mine would call. And they did. But more on that next time. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Reed Frazier.
Well,
We'll hear what happens next with Dave Hathaway next week here on Inside Appalachia. Thanks to the Allegheny Front for partnering with us on that story. The Allegheny Front is produced out of Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. You can find more at theAlleghenyFront.org. We love hearing from our listeners, and it's been interesting to hear how different people are reacting to the series. Morgan Billups is an admissions counselor at Concord University. She writes, "I really enjoy listening to the shows and hearing the issues and struggles that people in our region continue to face. I especially love the struggle to stay portions, as that's something I can relate to. As someone who loves West Virginia more than most, I always saw myself staying here when I was growing up. But then things change and life takes us down different paths. I lived in North Carolina for a summer during college and eventually moved to Tennessee twice. After 4 years in my time in Chattanooga, I realized that West Virginia was where I wanted to be. It's where my family is. It's where my people are, where the hills hug you each morning and night. Making the conscious decision to leave a thriving city for West Virginia wasn't easy, and a lot of people questioned me for it. It's hard to explain what draws you back. And now that I've been back for a year and a half, I find myself questioning why I'm staying. It's a very surreal feeling to want to stay and leave simultaneously. Thank you for continuing to showcase our state and its people." Thanks for that message, Morgan. And here's Jessica Salfia, an English teacher in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. She says, "I was the 2016 Berkeley County Teacher of the Year. I have a master's degree and almost 15 years of experience. I could drive 25 to 30 minutes to Maryland or Virginia and nearly double my salary, but I don't. I won't leave. This is my home. I want people to know West Virginia has good teachers and good schools. I want to make this place better and inspire our young people to stay." Thank you for your messages. If you have thoughts you'd like to share about the struggle to stay or Inside Appalachia, send us an email to feedback@wvpublic.org or find us on Twitter @InAppalachia. In Jeanette Wall's book, The Glass Castle, she tells the story of her father throwing her in the deep water of the pool, basically telling her to sink or swim. "My dad threw us in the deep water. I can remember fighting my way to the top of the water, and when I got there, Daddy pulled me out and told me he knew that I could do it. You see, he believed in me, even though I didn't believe in myself. We're told that being brave is doing what you have to do, even though you're scared. Trying new things can be scary, but I always knew that if I wanted to reach my goals, I had to get over my fears. Like Jeanette Walls, my mother always told me I was going to be somebody, and I believed her. She helped to create these dreams and passions, and I guess my daddy helped me to overcome any fear to help make it happen. Growing up, I was convinced I was just as strong, if not stronger, than any boy in my class. And, well, let's just say I did beat a boy in an arm wrestling match a time or two. And when a boy laughed in my face in middle school, well, let's just say for that one, he never did it again. I'm finding that I want to be somebody who shares everything that I've learned that helped me in order to encourage others." Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front, WNYC, and their podcast, On the Media. Music in today's show was provided by Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Michael Howard, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd and I produced the show together. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. You can find us online on Twitter @InAppalachia. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.